Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey guys, welcome to And the Writer Is. I'm your host, Ross Golan. I've written with hundreds of artists and writers over the years, and my favorite part of each session is the first hour when we catch up about life, the industry, politics, composition, whatever. So this is a journey of learning why people write songs, how people write songs, and most importantly, who the people are who write the songs. I'm producing this with the great Joe London, Big Deal Music Publishing, and Mega House Music Management. If you want to listen to the songs we discuss in this podcast, follow us on our socials, find out about special live events, or buy that merch, aka that hat I always wear, go to our website, www.andthewriteris.com. For a little bit of context, we just wanted you to know that a lot of these were recorded before quarantine. And as we know, a lot has changed in 2020. So again, please stay safe out there and enjoy the new episodes of And the Writer Is. Welcome to And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. Today's living legends reinvigorated one of the biggest brands in show business the way Alan Menken and Howard Ashman did three decades ago. They've won Oscars and Grammys together to prove it. But this superpower couple took two separate paths to get here. After they, side note, met at the BMI Theater Workshop, they each individually went on to compose award-winning musicals. One of them became the youngest and fastest to win the EGOT and is now the only human with a second EGOT, the record of all records. For those who don't know, that's an Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and a Tony. But the sum of their parts has written the evergreen of all evergreens. And together, they continue to write some of the most ubiquitous songs in the entire world. From New York and Connecticut, where they are now, by way of the stage, the screen, the bigger screen, and your streaming service, these two demonstrate that you can have a successful family and play music professionally at the same time. And the writer is our Kristen Anderson Lopez and Bobby Lopez. Welcome.
Wow. Hi, Thank Ross.
That was over the top.
I know. I think we needed that. I think it's been a long time since we felt good about ourselves. Can you come every day and say something?
I'll make a deal with you guys that anytime you guys need to pick me up, I'm up early. You guys should call me and just say, hey, can you reread that intro?
Ross, maybe read that intro again.
Or maybe we could just listen to the podcast again.
Oh, that's right. Oh, we could save you the trouble and let you sleep in.
That's fine too. Okay. So, I mean, what better way to start than with our first guest question before we even get to it? John Bozzetti would like to ask you guys.
That's our agent.
That's my agent too, by
the
way.
That's your agent? Oh my God. Yeah,
agent brothers.
Agent twins.
Yeah, agent twins. What is it like to live and work together 24/7?
I mean, most of the time, I'm going to say 99 44/100 of the time, it's the best. It's just the best. He's my best friend. He makes me laugh every second of the day. And then there's the occasional 66/100 of the time that if we're both feeling stressed or scared and we aren't able to access that, access the words to say I'm stressed and scared, then we can really lash out at each other. But it's very rare.
I'm sorry. I just remembered. I meant to hit record on our end so we could send you audio. Do you need it?
I mean, I don't know. Joe, we can probably do it from here, yeah, Joe? Or should
Does
we
sound
start
okay
over?
Enough?
Joe, can you hear us? Joe, are you there? Joe, did you go say hi to Sonny? Sonny's his son. I don't know. I think we can keep going.
Okay, no? All right. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to stop us, but I just realized, oh.
No, it's okay. We're good. Okay.
I had given a big, like, Brene Brown power of vulnerability answer, and then you were like, I got to hit the recording equipment.
Well, okay. As you said, 66/100th of the time you have issues. And I mean, not to jump into other guest questions, because I will get into our normal, the way our normal show. But another one of our friends, Adina Menzel, asked the question. She says, when you don't really like an idea proposed by your significant other, how do you effectively and gracefully communicate that? So that just sort of runs into this. So I feel like I have to just jump into the second question.
That's a really good question too. And it kind of builds into the first thing, and it's all about really communicating honestly and remembering, for me, like when we first started, I always thought, okay, whenever I'm writing a song with somebody, the song is the most important thing. And as long as we get to a great song, we've achieved something and we've spent this hour well or whatever. But through working with Kristen, I think I've realized that what's most important is the person you're working with. Just people are more important than art in the end. and that the art won't, if you put the person first, the art will never suffer. It always comes out actually probably better. And you don't burn through your collaborations as much. You don't create a well of ill will. So, you know, things like ideas that you don't spark to, you have to try them. You really should try them. And usually, if they aren't sparking, eventually both of you will see it. So it's one of those emotional lessons that's hard to learn, and I always forget. And I will knock down ideas from time to time, but I try not to. We try and try everything.
There are moments where, I can think of one when we were really still trying to solve the end of Frozen Broadway. And we had sort of made a rule that we weren't going to use Let It Go at the end. But finally, something sort of hit me. And I was like, I actually think we need to use Let It Go at the end to have Anna sing it to her. And I had to really almost use like, okay, this is me using the you get to try it card, that we very rarely have to ever use, but there are occasionally times that I just have to say, trust me, just go with me, play with me. I know you think this is wrong, but just pretend like you think it's right. And then he got it under his finger. You know, we were sort of improvising it at the piano. And then I could you could see the way that it was working sort of wash over him. And suddenly he was like, you're right.
Yeah.
But I had to really force it.
I'd say like most of the time, if you let yourself try your collaborator's idea, you'll be won over by it. And you'll see what was so great about it that I don't know about you, but I get into these time-saving ways of thinking where I kind of know what'll work for me, and I know what's a quick way to get to something really good. But it's very important. I mean, just think about that. You don't want to be stuck in that spot as an artist. The great thing about having a collaborator is ideas you wouldn't have thought of.
Also, we have a rule. We want to get a sign for our office that says, do not hit head on wall. We have a rule that when we're just really not finding it, that we just say, you know what, let's take a break, let's go for a walk, or maybe it's time for lunch. Blood sugar can be an important thing, making sure we stop and have protein and a nice...
And intimate relations. I mean, that's one of the... that's part of what we have that other songwriters don't.
We have been known to do that. Sorry if our kids are listening.
And sometimes... it's as simple as just walking through a door. I mean, how many times do people talk about where they have, you know, there's... this cheesy Nashville joke that you hear when it's like an epiphany.
Yes, epiphany.
Yeah,
yep.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it's like walking through doors. It's so simple, and it's probably good advice just in life. It's you know, it's okay to stand up, walk around, think for a second, and come back to something, because the only way you get perspective is time, and it you know, that's what having a good collaborator does, is they cut down that time a little bit, you know. But if you guys are single-minded in some ways, then that, you know, I imagine that it helps to just take a break. Do you find that you guys end up, because you've written together so long now, do you find that you guys have the same ideas, you know, Bobby, like you were saying, where you have a shortcut sometimes to something good? Is it hard for you guys to break out? You know, even I want to go through your story a little bit, but the feel of your songs vary. So somebody's coming in and saying, how about we try a song like this? And you guys are still pushing each other. But do you guys find it hard to think outside of the collective box when you have the same collaborator?
One of the great things about having kids, and they play such an important part in our lives, they keep growing and evolving. So the, you know, when we were writing Frozen 1, the movie, we had little kids that were obsessed with princesses and wearing princess dresses. Now we have a teen and a tween, and, you know, they're exposing us to all kinds of amazing indie bands that you can only find on TikTok. And what's wonderful when you're growing along with a human is that we keep evolving and our references keep evolving, because we've got a human being evolving that we are in charge of. Two of them, actually.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's really wise. I want to tell a little bit of your story, because I always think it's important to realize that humans, that you two are both humans and not just, you know, who you guys are, that you guys had to get here. So both of you are born in some place in New York, or raised in New York, I should say. So let's do the, you know, what's the Cliff's Notes version? Because there's so much that happened after you guys met. But from you guys being born to BMI, a BMI theater writing camp, not a camp, it's a
workshop.
Yeah. A workshop. That's where you guys met. So, you know, let's start. Kristen, go give us a little bit of your background. Are your parents musicians?
My parents aren't musicians, though my father really should have been. He's a natural lyricist, and we talk about the genetic mutation, because I am a lyricist, and my two other sisters are also lyricists, also working. Also, you know, my sister Kate is working on Central Park. So I'm going to give you the short version, though. I grew up in Westchester, and I fell in love with musicals really, really early, like 3 or 4. And by 5, you know, I got to see Annie on Broadway. And we used to have a whole group of neighborhood kids outside that didn't have anything to do. And I used to put musicals on in the backyard, like get them all to play parts. And I directed and starred and designed and marketed for these musicals. And looking at it now, you know, I really was in love with with making theater, but the narrative
and dressing your brother up in women's clothes.
Yes, making my poor brother, who's on the spectrum, he's Asperger's. He had to wear a lot of tutus and things. I kind of downloaded a narrative early on that women who like theater have to be actresses. So I really bought into I'm going to be a Broadway actress dream. And did a lot of acting. My parents then moved to Charlotte, North Carolina, where I was in a lot of shows in Charlotte. And then in college, I was a theater and psychology double major, because my dad insisted that I have a fallback.
And your fallback was psychology?
My fallback was psychology. And I used that psychology card. I ended up working with schizophrenic patients for a while in my 20s. When the acting thing just wasn't what I wanted it to be. I graduated from Williams with this wonderful degree, and I was playing all these nuns in New Hampshire. I was doing the whole audition thing. You know, was called back for Rent twice, but always never got in. We almost got the national tour playing Zeidel and Fiddler on the Roof, but I wasn't Jewish enough, they told me. You know, all these, I kept getting a close chance of the dream, the ticket out of hell, but I always ended up just playing a nun in New Hampshire. And so I quit the business, worked with schizophrenic patients for a while, came back to the business. And finally, one day, someone told me, Mark Holman of the writer of Urinetown, told me, like, you're a lyricist, because I was rewriting all these lyrics backstage and always making parodies. And
she was in the original Fringe Urinetown.
I was in the original. And I was solidly mediocre. I played an old lady. I played Ma Strong, and I was definitely mugging a lot. But anyway, I got into BMI, and the moment that I played my first song and I saw how it landed and it made people laugh, it was really like the sky just opened and was like, this is what you're supposed
to do. That's your first song? You know, was that also your first song, or was that the first song you performed in front of people where you could tell?
It really was like my first original song. Everything up until then had been parodies that I wrote for different shows. This really was the first time that I had been brave enough to use my own words and work with a composer that I was assigned to, and see what it was if I became a writer. And it just felt like, oh, this, it felt like home to me.
What was that?
I fell in love with it. What was that song called? The first assignment at BMI is a sad hello or a happy goodbye. So I wrote a happy goodbye, and it was called How to Say Goodbye to Randall High from the perspective of a really type A valedictorian who had been bullied all through high school. So it was her giving this speech and telling everybody off.
Wow.
It was fun.
Yes.
It also exorcised some of my high school demons.
It gives you hope when you can, you know, the all an artist needs is a little bit of hope to keep going. And I think even just getting close to getting into shows is better for, or worse, for prolonging a career. For, you know, as long as you're close, that'll keep you going, you know. And even those moments of satisfaction, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I imagine that feeling, that success, even at that BMI workshop the first time, probably has, you know, I see the joy that you have when you speak about it. My assumption is that for you holds a similar place as some of the awards that you've won and some of the other things that you've been around, to know that, wow, this is the moment that I feel like I should pursue this.
Absolutely. Not only was she the sort of top of her class at BMI as a lyricist, but she was also sort of this dazzling beauty. There weren't a lot of girls in the class. She was like, all the guys just wanted to be with her.
Dazzling beauty is a relative thing in a class full of writers.
But she was super confident and excited. I just remember, like, her eyes just sparkled, you know, with excitement and like you said, hope.
I think
refreshing, hope, renewal, all that stuff.
Hope is the key word, because, or the ability to be proactive. One of the things that was so frustrating as a performer for me was to have to do something I wasn't great at, which is auditioning. And I had to sort of beg for a job, and I had to go through this thing that brought up all this anxiety and tightness for me in order to get to do what I loved. And here as a writer, I found this ability to all the paths were open to me as long as I was in control. I was the one who could persist. I was the one who could, you know, fall on my face or write a bad song and then get up the next day and write another song, which is different than when you fall on your face, you don't get a job as an actor, and then you're waiting for the next audition and you're going in without control. For me, it was about control.
Another theme.
A lot of singers are, if you sing well and you're little, then somebody, they naturally just say, go on stage. And either you end up in a band, or you end up in an a cappella group, or you end up in something where you have to perform. And you have to, I think a lot of songwriters have to deal with this moment of, I'm actually not made to be a performer. You know, that some of it is a, it doesn't mean you can't write for a performer or even perform in a studio.
Right.
You know, but maybe that doesn't mean you have to perform in front of, you know, that it's not about being on stage.
Well, yes. And I think that so many of my friends who are still in the business are also wonderful auditioners, and they also have whatever that ability is to compartmentalize, like, okay, that was a bad audition. I'm going to relax and go in differently next time. Where, and I don't know if that has to do with birth order. I have the little psychologist in me loves to look at, like, second, third children do much better than first children. First children go into that audition room with the expectations, with the Elsa, I must be perfect, kind of thing. And I think second and third children have been beaten up since the second they existed. And they're just a little more resilient and a little more like, ah, I didn't win this time, but I'm going to get them next time. That's just a theory.
One question about being a lyricist in this world. And I wish that, you know, I find that a lot of pop, country, hip hop writers tend to not edit lyrics, and they tend to feel like that the moment that they write it, it, that there's some sort of magic that they're supposed to leave it the way they, you know, that day. And if you work at all in theater, part of the joy is the editing and finding, oh no, there's a better word. And it might have been weeks, months, years later, and you still think of better words.
Absolutely. And
as a lyricist who excels even at that point, how close to a first draft are you? Do you have a consistent process?
We don't have a consistent process. Different songs come out in different ways. You know, just to use specific examples, Do the Next Right Thing was written like in one sitting at the side of my bed in a towel because I'd just gotten the whole song. I've been thinking about our friend Chris Buck, who had lost his son, who's the director of Frozen and Frozen 2, along with Jennifer Lee. And the song just sort of came out. And then I handed it to Bobby, and he had this tune. And those are the nice ones. Then there's often a lot of time that I'll scribble something, I'll show it to Bobby. Bobby's a wonderful mirror and wonderful person to say, I really like this line, and I think that's our song. And we'll talk it out, and, you know, sometimes we'll wrestle it together on a whiteboard.
Yeah, we talk a lot. And I always like to procrastinate by talking, so that by the end of all the talking, of weeks of talking about a song, you kind of have the song, and then you can just put it together.
Yeah, I mean, that process of defining what the song's about is something, you know, I'm trying to get writers to not just write a title, but to go through the first draft, write a poem, try to flesh out the idea more, because by the time you get there weeks later and you're in a session, you've already thought of, you know, how many ways the song could go. Bobby, tell me a little bit about your history, because you were born in the city, right?
Yeah. I was born in Manhattan. My parents were NYU folks. They met at NYU when they were going there and working there. And they were both, neither of them were musicians at all, but my dad had really wanted to be a short story writer or a novelist or something in fiction, and he ended up in PR. And my mom had a very strong spirit just in terms of follow your joy, like do something that makes you happy. Don't end up in a job that's going to make you depressed your whole life. And I think she identified with artists. So I think she pushed me and my brother, who was also a creative guy, into this field, really. Like, as soon as I expressed an interest in music, they signed me up for lessons. So I had said, when I was four, I said, I want a guitar for Christmas. And they were like, "Oh, we're going to get you a really good guitar. We're going to sign you up for lessons." I was like, no, I just want the plastic Mickey Mouse guitar in the drugstore that I saw. I just want that one." But eventually we moved to Massachusetts, and then that didn't work out. We moved back to New York into a sublet that had a piano, and that was the piano. They were like, "Okay, here's a sign. Let's sign him up for lessons on this." And that's where I got started. My piano teacher was different in that he had me write songs from very young, and I started writing songs at seven because and he would make me write them out. I was like, you want me to write the music on the paper? And my first song was it was called "Oy Vey, What a Day." Hmm. It was a very Jewish themed song for a little half Filipino kid, and then I got into acting in school, high school. I was in West Side Story in fifth grade, and then Fiddler on the Roof. And then I was in a drama group where I got to write songs for original shows that they did. And it got to be me writing a show every semester, which was really great practice. And
are these normal length 2 hour, intermission shows that you were writing at the time?
No, they were they ended up being teen kind of issue oriented. There'd be one about, there was one about all the issues. It was like AIDS and teen pregnancy and chemical dependency and just like all the most depressing things in one show. And like, they were an hour long.
Bobby's going to kill me if I bring up a song that we just recently found in his eighth grade yearbook. No. What was it called?
That was my Billy Joel phase. I wrote a song called "The Red Tape of Society."
The Red Tape of Society.
When I was in sixth grade, yeah, that was an intermediate step that I don't discuss much.
The girls and I are making so much fun of him because the whole song was about how he clearly had a crush on a girl from uptown, yeah. And his the hook being "Let's fight the red tape of society" is like, "Will you date me?"
Did you guys want to perform outside of theater? Were you guys ever playing at clubs in New York, or were you ever trying to do that, or was it always this was going to be theater?
I did write pop songs for 5 minutes for a group called The Strines, and they were basically to be played during Dawson's Creek when they didn't want to license real rock songs, so they would license these and make them seem like they were the real thing playing on the radio. So that was my only foray into pop.
It was like those fake TVs in a furniture store.
Right. Yeah.
You guys have written you guys have written a lot of lyrics and a lot of music to an existing book, which is different than in other genres where there is a story already in place, but there has to be some sort of interaction with the book writer, I assume, when you're writing lyrics. Explain how that process works.
Well, it's really chicken and egg is really the best way to explain it. It's not like when we went to write original music for an animated movie. It's not like there's a script and it says like, write this song and this song and this song. It starts with an idea. The idea that we came or that we started with on Frozen was like, there's two sisters. At the end, the true love that saves them is their own, not the prince's. Let's write that musical. And it involves hours and hours of talking with the story team and the director and the writer, hours of songs that fall on the floor. I think we wrote 25 songs for Frozen, and there's 7.5 in the movie. Not all completely written. Some of them are completely written and even demoed. It's very, everything that we've done has been creating the original story with the team.
Yeah, at Disney, it involved a lot of what we're doing now like video conferencing. We would video conference with the team in Burbank since we live in Brooklyn. Every day, you know, not every day, every week, but for weeks at a time, it's a daily call. And sometimes we have a lot to discuss and sometimes it's less, but they've always pushed the ball forward on, you know, some on their end and have stuff to share with us. And sometimes we, who spend less time with our heads in the movie, have gained some perspective that they don't have. We bring fresh eyes to the story. And as you know, not every story wants to be a musical. So that's why we kind of, it's good for us to be there so much so we can keep our eye on, okay, is this, are these characters, characters that would sing? Is this, is the story kind of going to give us the fuel that we need for this to be a musical? And they're wonderfully creative and collaborative at Disney. And they let us be there for so much of it. It was such a huge privilege to get to see the process over there from the inside, see the art that that gets generated. It's amazing.
You guys, you know, you guys met at the BMI Theater Workshop, and that's, it seems like from there you guys were able to really enter the musical theater world in New York on a really official level. You guys start making musicals that are being produced. You started, you know, Bobby, you started working on Avenue Q with somebody, another person you met at the BMI Theater Workshop. So this place must have been incredible.
We tell everyone that wants to write for musicals to go join BMI, because I mean, certainly our experience was we had this amazing class. My class had me and Jeff Marks and Amanda Green, and Curtis Moore and Tom Miser and Tom Kitt and Brian Yorkey. They were all in one class, and
their class was epically good.
It was a great class, and not only that, there were all these other wonderful people who were equally talented, and they all formed a unit, an audience. Really, like that was the main thing. You got to try out your song and see where the audience laughed. You got a sense of, you know, a sense of community, a sense of somebody wants to hear what you've written, which is very rare. It's really invaluable to a young writer. And Kristen and I met through that community. It was such a great thing. And Jeff and I really bonded through humor, and that was what I really loved about BMI. I found this new joy, new passion about making the class break up and laugh. And Avenue Q came out of that. It was a lot of fun to bring in another song and see how they would laugh.
And Maury Estin was our teacher. Maury Estin was the teacher of the advanced, and talk about an artist who is so generous with his appreciation. Not every artist is like this. It's very easy to feel threatened by other writers coming up the pike, even. And Maury Estin just exemplified mentorship. You know, he just was happy to say, "This is incredible! Wow!" And would read your lyrics in this wonderful Maury Estin way, and be like, "The sun is shining. It's a lovely day. Perfect, whatever, for the kid to play." It was so fun to hear your lyrics in his language, in his voice.
When you talk about there being, not all stories are made for musicals, and then your first musical at the that level is one with puppets, that seems like it's sort of almost counterintuitive. I loved seeing it, and I remember seeing it and being like, this is exactly what a musical should be. But I imagine that there are a lot of traditionalists who probably did not really react well to that at first. It probably took a few people, you know.
I guess a lot of people didn't get it, and especially the people who didn't see the readings which had puppets, and where you saw them come to life and, you know, really believe in them. And so it was hard to get off the page. Are you hearing the kind of digital breakup?
Yeah, I'm hearing digital breakup too.
On your end?
I'm not hearing
okay,
that.
Okay, hang on. Let me just quit out of Logic here.
Okay. Sorry, I was wondering if it was just me.
You guys sound like angels.
Yeah,
exactly.
How's that? That's better.
All of a sudden you're just talking, but it's just angels just... no, it sounds clear, so it's probably sounding clear
cool.
for them.
Yeah. Awesome.
Great. Where were we?
You were saying how people didn't get to see the workshops where they could see the actual, you know, puppets kind of come to life.
Yeah. Anyone that saw the workshop of Avenue Q knew that it was something special and knew that it would work on stage. But anyone that heard the word puppet or just read the script without a sense of what it would look like and how it would make you feel and what was funny about it, they all kind of tended to say, this is not going to go well.
Like my parents, when I was like, well, I'm dating a guy, he lives with his parents, and he's writing this amazing puppet musical.
forgetting Sarah Marshall, which clearly, you know, was somewhat influenced by that.
I've always wondered
about that too.
You have to wonder that hard. I think it has to be that, but a definite solid homage. You know, you after the success of that, which wins all of the awards that you can hope a show can win, I imagine that starts to change your own, not that you lacked confidence going into it, but it probably... I guess the question is, did it inspire you to make sure you never followed the rules from then on? You know what I mean? Because your shows are always a little bit left of center. The things that you guys both do independently are a little left of center. Was it the success of that kind of gives you...
I think I sort of had a rule in my mind that you would want to change one thing, but keep another thing traditional. So in the case of Avenue Q, the content was, the subject matter of it was kind of crazy, but the, what am I trying to say?
Subversive joy. I think that the word is subversive joy. Everything that you do, everything that we do, has to have a little bit of like the joy that makes something sing and then that subversive attitude. And I mean, as your wife, I think that one of the superpowers Bobby has is that because he is this 3/8 Filipino person who doesn't see himself very readily in any way. There's no 3/8 Filipino community that he can be part of. He's always been a little bit of like, I watch from the outside. And so everything that he does has a little bit of an outsider's perspective and the subversion that comes with it. And that's my analysis of him.
Yeah, I think that's right. And also the idea of, I think musicals have come back in a big way now, but back in the late 90s, they were kind of less in the center of our culture compared to now. And it felt necessary to do something different, to attract people and to make them relevant to our generation. So the idea of, animated musicals seemed like a no-brainer, but no one was offering us those jobs. However, we did know a puppeteer, and no one had done a live puppet comedy on stage. And nobody but we kind of knew the charm that puppets coming to life right in front of your eyes brought to it. And then with Book of Mormon, which was a show that dropped, you know, sort of came to me because Matt and Trey saw Avenue Q and realized how inspired by them I was. That show came about, and it needed to be a very, very traditional seeming show with a twisted center.
Yeah, I think that's one of those things, you can't rush it. And your careers have been very patient And if you look at a discography and do an interview today, it seems like, wow, there's so much stuff that happens just back to back to back to back. But these things take so long to develop. You know, you start writing it and it takes, and it's 6 years before they get made into a show. Why does it take so long?
Well, the story has to be right. And in the case of everything that we're talking about, we're not adapting anything that exists. It's always creating original story. I mean, Avenue Q is an original musical. Book of Mormon, In Transit, Frozen, Coco. Right now,
Frozen 2
up here, which is something we've had going for a long, long time, and now is pivoting
back in our lives.
They're all original, so you need to get the characters right. You need to get the outer story right, the inner story right. And it's like building a building. You can't just put up the Empire State Building. You've got to make sure you've got the correct blueprints and then the correct materials and then the correct the correct feng shui inside of it.
Somehow, I think also for non-musical projects, when you write the script for a straight play or a movie, and then somebody reads it, they can get a sense of what the story is just from reading it. But with a musical, you really have to see it on its feet. And the chances are that the first draft doesn't work, because as you're writing it, you think you have something, but it's a collaboration between the audience, the songs, and the story at once. It creates its own energy that you can only really feel when there's an audience there, and that takes a lot to put together, and you have to do a few of those in order to get the whole thing right.
You wrote, in order to get an EGOT, you have to get an Emmy, which you get another one later. But what's sort of special about the first one you win is that you wrote it with your brother.
Yeah.
That's pretty awesome. And both you guys have siblings that do music and do like the same, not even just music, but kind of do the exact same thing. It's not like one is like, oh, I'm a jazz, a jazz bassist, and the other guy's like, for lyrics, like does whatever random beatnik poetry. You guys all do similar things and can collaborate with your actual siblings.
It's the tyranny of birth order again. You know, we're the first children, and our and our younger siblings, you know, just idolize us and look at us.
Family reunions are very fun, though. I was just thinking back to last Christmas. We had everybody, both sides of the family, all together, and we just pulled out all the instruments and had such a fun Christmas jam.
That was awesome.
With everybody playing, Bobby playing the piano, his brother on the electric guitar, my daughter on the bass. I think I had this thing called a Jingle and Johnny in lieu of drums.
Have you seen one of these? It's amazing. It's a stick that has a snare, like a pie plate with a snare on it, and a bell that you can hit with a stick. And
there's a cowbell element to it.
Yeah, and the bass drum is just hitting there's like a rubber ball on the bottom, and you hit it against the floor, and it thumps.
It's a fun instrument, unless you live above somebody.
That feels like a solid apartment instrument, though, because it's a whole band in one. That's fantastic.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
It's a shake weight with a band. And
exactly. Yeah, actually, my arm was killing me for like a whole week after I played that thing for like 4 hours.
Just a Popeye bicep. Just one. Yeah. Let's talk about In Transit. I was in an acapella group with one of the members of your cast when I was in college.
Were you in the SoCal Vocals?
Oh, the SoCal Vocal.
Yeah, I did my research. We loved the SoCal Vocals on the a cappella contest. What was it called?
The sing-off.
Yeah, there were a bunch of people that we have in common, partly just from that, because so many of them went to New York to work in theater and audition for things you guys have been a part of. James Snyder was in your show. You know, that was...
I love him.
It was fun to, it's always just fun to watch it. I happen to just watch a lot of your shows go from off Broadway to Broadway and see that. And one of my questions with In Transit is, you know, that going from off-Broadway to Broadway had a larger shift in its in a way like the tone of some of the show that I saw from its infancy to that. And I didn't see, you know, small versions of Avenue Q's and or Book of Mormon, so I can't speak to that. But, you know, being a part of a show that's been off Broadway and moving it to Broadway and seeing the transition of that, you have to make, I'm sure, a lot of different story choices and a lot of different musical choices. What was it like to do the first all a cappella show on Broadway, but to have to take something that's that intimate, you know?
That was very challenging. It was very challenging in so many ways. It was challenging because one of the hardest things about being in previews is how quickly you need to move and pivot. And it's one thing, I mean, it's very difficult when you make a big change to then have the copyists there that have to make the change in all of the orchestrations, and then they have to rehearse it right before the show the next night. Imagine doing this, but you're a cappella. So you have, it's not like you have the sheet music in front of you. Any change, we had to be careful to use existing bars of music people already knew, or it was going to mean hours of vocal rehearsal. That was just one of the numerous things that made, you know, many, many reasons why it's never been done before. And we discovered them all.
I mean, one thing that was amazing is that all of the actors had in-ears.
Yes.
And their own board mix, which yes. No other show has that for the actors. I mean, you know, the band's playing, they may have their own board mix, you know, the drummer's going to have a different mix and whatever, but actors to have that, I can't imagine how complicated that is.
It was so complicated. And our cast, I mean, they're all so lovely and close because they became such a family because they truly were out there without a net, just each other every single night. And Rick Hip Flores, our musical director, who was in their in-ears, who also was playing the notes so that they could get their pitches. But there was a whole world in their in-ears. And then they were having to act and change costume and move sets. I mean, it was
a shame because you kind of needed to know a little bit about a cappella to understand how hard what they were doing was. It didn't look as hard as it was. They made it look effortless, but yeah, that show was it was a miracle that it happened.
I'm very proud that we did something that's never been done before. But it also taught me a lesson of how ultimately story drives everything. Ultimately, if you're doing the job right, people forget how hard the music is, and the story is what they're paying attention to. And even when people are like literally jumping through hoops to make the music with their own voices.
So interesting. So that's been the complicated part for me in that world is learning about, you know, intention, obstacle, and tactics, and how as to bring that into the pop world, having learned that from the theater world, that you can't just have an actor walk on stage and just sing a song because the song's good. They actually have to want something. They have to want to achieve it. You know, there has to be something in the way. That there's a reason why they're singing that song.
And who are they talking to often?
Who are they talking to? And in the pop world, you often just have somebody just saying, a matter of fact, this is something that exists. And it's like, well, but how is that, you know, how do you expect even an artist to want to cut that? They also have to, you know, I was trying to use the example, sorry, this is a circuitous, but, you know, in a painting, I tend to not really like just still life, this is a vase. But if you had an empty vase and you had somebody reaching to try to put flowers in the vase, but their arms are too short, I would look at that painting and I would probably put that on my wall. Because that actually is like the struggle of putting
conflict.
The flowers in the vase.
Conflict, yeah.
Conflict.
Our little, our youngest used to, Bobby would tell these stories at night, and she would get really upset at him if there wasn't enough conflict. Like, Dad, something needs to happen.
It's boring.
It's boring. Having kids makes you realize, like, your stories better have some conflict or nobody cares.
Totally true. Why did it take so long for you guys to collaborate? Here you guys, you know, Book of Mormon comes out in the middle of between In Transit off Broadway and going to Broadway. Book of Mormon is a big success. You guys are getting nominated and winning awards. And why aren't you guys writing all these things together from the...
Funny you should ask. Because we had started writing together early on. And when we were dating, we did a couple of songs for Disney Channel. And that was a fun way to spend time, to justify spending time away from our other collaborators and to get to spend it together. And then when we were married, Kristen had the opportunity to write something for Disney theme parks. She wrote a treatment for Finding Nemo the musical, and they bought it. It was sold, and they said, which composer would you like to work with on it? And she said, actually, my husband, I'm married to Bobby Lopez. And they were like, oh, okay, cool. So we made a show called Finding Nemo the musical, which up until the pandemic was so sad. The pandemic kind of, I wonder if it's killed it. I don't know.
We don't know. All of the employees are, if not furloughed, let go at this moment. So I don't know if it's coming back or not. I hope it is.
But it played from 2006 to 2019 in that park in Disney's Animal Kingdom, Florida. And then we were writing a show called Up Here, which was a... This was while we were doing Book of Mormon and In Transit. We were also writing this other show, which was a very ambitious show about a guy's brain, basically. The guy who was in a relationship. He was an introverted guy in a relationship with an extroverted girl. And it was a little bit...
Had autobiographical
elements to it.
Yeah.
And it was a very difficult show to develop. We developed it with the director, Alex Timbers, for a while, and that culminated with a show, with a production in La Jolla in 2015, which happened right after Frozen. But right. that took forever.
Right. That was a long one, in part because we also had two children in the middle of all of that. Having children is the greatest thing that we've ever done together, but it definitely slowed down our collaboration for a second because one of us, when they were really, really small, it was mostly me, needed to kind of stop and you know, breastfeed them and bond with them for at least the first year. So
I didn't breastfeed as much.
Yeah, Bobby.
But we actually also, and we wrote another movie called Winnie the Pooh for Disney Animation. That came out in 2011 too. So we actually have been working together on this parallel career for our entire marriage.
And the truth is, everything that I did without Bobby, he was secretly whispering in my ear the whole time. And everything he did without me, I was maybe not so secretly whispering in his ear. I remember once
giving notes, talking in my ear,
coming up after a workshop. And, you know, giving some really basic notes of saying, you know, well, you really need to let us know in Book of Mormon, you need to let us know that, you know, the Africans getting baptized are aware that this is just metaphors or whatever. And realizing I was giving him notes in front of Scott Rudin.
Right. And some of those notes we knew.
I would ask about Scott Rudin, but I know that'd be a separate podcast. So let's go to, but I am curious about Book of Mormon. You know, it becomes so big. It's such a big show. I mean, Avenue Q is a big show. In Transit's a big show. But I know that, you know, Book of Mormon ends up having this, you know, it's toured around. It's so big. It's a different, even the puppeteers, a show with puppeteers is a different skill set. So it's probably harder to tour that, I would imagine, than in the same level that Book of Mormon, where you can probably have, I guess some high schools might allow them to do it. You know, it just seems like a show that
No, there's not a lot of high schools doing Avenue Q in Book of Mormon.
Book of Mormon is just such a big show. Did that change your perspective on theater when you see, you know, you guys have seen shows work where you guys make a living at it and have done well and won awards, but there's a different thing, at, you know, when you have a show that's that big.
I thought Avenue Q was the, I thought it would be the pinnacle of my career, and it was pretty, it was a small show, but it was a big hit, and it really did change our lives completely, 100% opposite direction, because before Avenue Q, I could barely scrape together $20,000 a year. It was really a rough road to hoe. And then Avenue Q really, it was a great living for a really long time, and it allowed us to spend the time on projects, only the projects that we wanted to do. We never had to take a job for money. And nothing after that has ever been quite the same, because it's, my life already got changed by Avenue Q. And even when Frozen came out, that was amazing, but it, you know, my life didn't change. It was like, okay, now we have another hit. But
Avenue Q did. It was life changing for us, because we really were, while he was writing Avenue Q, we were living on my teaching artist's salary for a couple of months. And on the way to the opening night of Avenue Q, we also had to go to my temp job and pick up the check, or we were going to have no money, like not even cab fare to get home. I had to pick up the check and deposit it in the bank so it would hit that night, so we would have enough money to get through the weekend. Like we were scraping by. And then Avenue Q brought some abundance into our life. But it also, the thing that I think Bobby talks about eloquently, I've heard him talk about it, it also was a moment it changes your relationship to the freedom to fail. I think success can be very scary, and you kind of have to ride that wave and then say, like, this happened to me and now I have to go back to the blank page again and not carry the need to do it again. I experienced it fresh. I experienced what Bobby had talked about after Avenue Q, him saying, I've got to just get rid of the pressure. I've got to get rid of the pressure. I experienced it after Frozen, that it took a minute to just get your head back to beginner's mind to say, like, that's something that happened. And yes, you know, everyone in the world is singing Let It Go. And for a second, it was like everyone was singing Let It Go really happily. And then 6 months later, every parent was coming up and saying, like, my kid keeps singing Let It Go. And so there was like the fun ride, the fun wave, and then the aftershock. and to just say, like, that's outside of me, but I'm working on a new project. And I have a character who is just as alive and important and needs my attention as Elsa. So thank you, Elsa. Now we're going to write for Miguel, or whoever it is that we are writing for. You really have to just be the same person you were.
I mean, I think that's really eloquent. There are a lot of writers where, I don't see that, I don't see all your awards behind you. It may be in front of you, maybe in that room, I don't know. But a lot of, it's hard sometimes to be creative in a room that has all of your past accolades on the wall and look at it and say, sometimes I see it as looming and sometimes I see it as, no, it's okay. It's okay. Stick with it, because you didn't know in any of those either. So there's like there's that mind game when you're dealing with success, and the success that you guys have had is a different thing. When you were talking about Let It Go, I think you summed it up really nicely.
The other thing that we found really helpful is that we realize, because often songs that we write land on the floor and nobody ever gets to hear them again. And that can be really devastating too. You know, if a story changes and we've just written our favorite song we've ever written, but now the character does something else because somebody changed it, their mind in Burbank. We used to get really upset about that. And now we realize that even when we go on vacation, we write songs together. Like we just love writing together. We love creating. So now we have this mantra of something falls on the floor and we just say like, well, it's an excuse to get to write another song and spend those hours, because I know it sounds kind of corny and it isn't always this way, but some of the best hours of my life will be those moments that we found that melody, or we found that hook, or we found the place where the lyric and the music just made my skin turn all goose pimply. And those are the highest moments of living for us sometimes.
Yeah. And when it goes well, we have a blast. We laugh. We sort of play act scenes, we improvise, and it's just fun. It's like a play date when we do it right. And we don't always do it right, as Kristen said. Sometimes it feels like hitting your head against that wall, and that's when you need that sign. Don't bang head against wall.
You know, you mentioned the JRB interview that we did, the Jason Robert Brown one, and you know, here's a guy who's writing everything alone. And it's a different thing when you have someone else in the room, that at least if you're going to, you know, it's hard to play act by yourself. You have to really lose yourself in that. And, you know,
definitely hard to do anything comic. I don't think I could write a comedy song by myself, but right. When Kristen's around, make each other laugh. We, you know, and you, if it actually makes you laugh out loud in the room, then it has a chance of making people laugh out loud in the seats.
And that's not to say we don't do things alone too, because, you know, often lately, I think because of the pandemic, we've been forced a little bit more to say, like if we have to write a song, I'll go off with a notepad and just disappear for 3 hours. And that means that somebody else has got to be making the lunch and making sure that the people are getting on their Zooms for the, you know, the virtual education. And then there'll be times that then I'll take over and I'll say like, Bobby, here's this lyric, do with it what you want. He gets 2 hours of uninterrupted time. The uninterrupted time has been the hardest challenge in this pandemic. And we've had to basically create shifts. So, and then sometimes we can find, we've found our groove a little bit more, where we can say like, okay, we've got 2 hours this afternoon.
Yeah, lunch used to be a treat that we ordered, and now it is something that we make for other people.
Every meal.
In this next segment, what would Lin-Manuel Miranda ask the Lopezes? He has a few questions for you guys.
Oh. Lin is my old school. Well, we weren't really in school together, but we went to the same school.
They both had the same teacher who did musicals. Like this teacher, Mrs. Ames, deserves an award because she is the person who created a love of musical theater for Bobby Lopez and Lin-Manuel Miranda, because
that's true.
They did the fifth grade musical every year at Hunter High School.
She was our muse.
The power of one educator.
That's amazing. Shout out Mrs. Ames for sure. He asked, how much changes between your first demo and your final arrangement? And just going back to what we were talking about, I thought that this was important. How much changes between your first demo and the final arrangement? That's his first question. Well, I guess his follow-up is, have you ever found really vital stuff along the way?
Oh, definitely. I mean, and it's different for every song. Some songs we make a piano demo and everything, you know, then the orchestrator creates an orchestration. We always write figures and an arrangement, and sometimes the orchestrator adds arrangement figures to it, and sometimes he or she just takes what we've done and puts it on the orchestra. And then there's sometimes when we make a demo that is more fully fleshed out with this and that, and I've been learning to work with an assistant to help some of my ideas kind of take shape. Because I never have time to wrestle with the samples. Some of these samples are really hard to learn how to use. They all have different interfaces, and I just don't have time to learn it, like how to make a string quartet. But I know what I want the string quartet to sound like. And so I've got this assistant, Justin, that knows all that technical stuff and is able to help bring some of our ideas to life. And that's been a nice way to grow in the last few years or so, where I'm able to actually be a little bit more in the arrangement. The next project we have coming out, which we're not allowed to announce our involvement with, but it's a Disney Plus series that's coming out in January. We did a lot of work on the songs and arrangement wise, and it was a blast to discover fun elements.
And the challenge is always making sure we leave room for our orchestrator collaborator to add something and plus it, and we don't say like, oh, we don't get too precious about what we created. And sometimes what we created was right, and anyone adding to it just sort of diminishes the purity of it. So you've really got to learn how to trust your ears and learn how to say, okay, am I holding on to what we had too hard, or do I know that this just diminished it? It's a tricky thing.
With Book of Mormon,
he said, have you ever lost the thread of a tune because the arrangement got too elaborate, hectic, you know, far from the original impulse?
Yeah, but we always trim it back.
Yes. Bobby is pretty strict about that. If something doesn't make it better, he will always say, like, pare it back.
I don't know if I could say this, but there was one time I was working with an orchestrator on a demo for Book of Mormon, and he said, and if you make me cut one more horn line, I will give you my AIDS.
Yeah, Bobby's, that's a good line. It's hard to get through Bobby's editorial presence on the arrangements, and I really trust Bobby's instincts, and only every once in a while I'll just be like, it needs more French horn, just give me more French horn.
Kristen has great instincts too. She's a big picture person, and I will get lost in the weeds sometimes, and she'll be like, actually it doesn't work because you have missed the big picture. We need something big on that beat.
And sometimes it's about talking to our collaborators almost using like literary metaphors, just saying like, we've gone too purple, and we need to, or even using like filters. I want cool, vivid, not warm.
But I've actually seen this work though. Kristen will talk to the whole orchestra in Warner Brothers studio, like the 100 people with violins and cellos and horns and flutes, and get on the mic and say, this is a vulnerable moment. You have to play vulnerably. And the conductor's like scratching his head going like, okay.
Oh, I'm so embarrassed that she's giving them acting notes.
But it works. Giving the orchestra acting notes works.
Because they are in a story where the music is telling an important part of like a decision and a feeling. And you've got 100 of the greatest musicians who clearly understand how to convey emotion through their gift. Sometimes I think of them as actors, and that we're all actors and we're all supporting, you know, the emotion that Adina is providing in her vocal. We all kind of need to be in that same place so it feels unified.
When you've been taught, you earlier, you mentioned how trying to deal with the success of Avenue Q and the success of Let It Go and what it was like to then have to follow up a hit. There's a TED talk by the woman who wrote Eat, Pray, Love about that. You know, the idea of how do you write your second opus?
Right. She wrote that beautiful book about it. Yeah. I never remember titles, but I read the book.
Unfortunately, we can't give you credit.
But I actually read that book after Frozen opened. It had nice timing because it was the summer, or it was like came out right after the year after Frozen had opened, and we were definitely grappling with how our life had changed and how the way people saw us changed. That was the hardest part.
We didn't feel like scrappy people anymore. Remember Me comes out and it wins your second Oscar, which has got to be like just the first one's great, but the second one is also one of those things where you probably get to appreciate it differently because.
Well, that was nice because we had written Remember Me before winning the Oscar for Let It Go. It was kind of already in the bag. That movie took a very long time because the release date kept changing. And we wrote a number of other songs for it too, but only Remember Me out of the songs we wrote remained in the film. And honestly, like the way that they created that movie and the loving attention to detail in the animation was just magical. It was really, and I still treasure getting to watch that scene, the way they put it together, every shot and expression just makes me cry.
Lee Unkrich is such a visionary and a extraordinary director. We were so lucky to work with him.
But we had to follow up the pressure of Frozen when we worked on Frozen 2. That was a pretty direct situation. It was a one-on-one scenario. Like, I take these characters again, write them another musical, following up on the first one, and go.
Right. Although I have to say, Jennifer Lee and Chris Buck, also extraordinary storytellers and people who had also been through their own journey on like Frozen hit, and it did something that none of us expected it would do. We just wanted to have a movie that didn't suck. That's all we were going for. and it did what it did. And so when we came together to work on Frozen 2, Jen and Chris said, there's no pressure. We will not put pressure on ourselves to write another Frozen. And you do not have to put pressure on yourself to write another Let It Go. We're going to do the same thing we did before, which is talk about story and theme and really find the emotions that have that connect to people and say something about life and change.
I mean, how often do Disney movies have successful sequels? I mean, this must be an exciting thing to be a part of. It feels like it's a new era. I mean, I know that they've had them, but there was an era where a lot of the sequels went straight to.
Right.
It was terrifying because writing a musical sequel is very challenging, because if you've done your job right the first time, you've let all the toothpaste out of the tube.
Yeah, totally.
And so we had to sort of find a way to find like where's the toothpaste that didn't come out? Like, oh, actually, is Elsa really where she belongs? Decorating, you know, making ice sculptures in the castle, is that really where Elsa belongs? And that's sort of the trail we chased.
Into the Unknown, which, congratulations, is nominated like crazy all over the place.
Thanks.
Did you know that was the, you know, I guess you would say the single? When you were done with it, was it designed to be the song from the movie? Or is it something where the movie's done and everyone says, nah, that's the song?
We didn't think about it that way. We were really looking for it. We were looking for what would be different in this movie. And I think one thing we found early was that Elsa was the protagonist of the story in a way that she wasn't in the first film. So in the first film, she didn't get an I Want song, and she didn't really go on a journey. She was reacting the entire time. She was running away, really. She was trying to avoid causing chaos and destruction and trying to avoid hurting her family. And then in Frozen 2, it became, for the first time in her whole life, she was happy enough to say, what is it that I want? What is it that I, you know, would want in my, you know, if I could want something? And that's what Into the Unknown was. It was her I Want song, really. It was her. And it was also telling the story of that she was called to something that she wasn't really ready to face, but was in the end something she needed to go through an adventure to get to.
One of the questions.
Yeah, I was just going to add that Show Yourself was written so late in the movie too. It was still coming together at the time that we had to submit everything. You're going to start hearing piano.
Annie's practicing.
Our daughter's playing Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. Show Yourself was later and really came together at the very, very end. You could see it on the Disney Plus documentary series, how late it came together. And so we didn't know that we could submit it because it hadn't been animated.
Plus, it was full of spoilers.
Yeah.
So that's another thing you don't often think about with writing a song.
One of the questions with the song, which is interesting, arrangement-wise, speaking of spoilers, Lynn also asked this question, which I really liked. He said, I'm obsessed with how the call in Into the Unknown is also the interval Elsa sings in the climax of the chorus. Did you work backwards from the chorus itself, or did you always have the call and build it into the song? Which came
first, the call? We had the call. We had the call because we wanted to use Dies Irae in the song. You know, Dies Irae is the church motif from the early beginnings of the church that's associated with death. And so we had the idea that there would be a voice, musical voice calling to her, and we decided it would be, ah. So then Elsa builds to Into the Unknown. I think we definitely were thinking she's echoing the call, right?
Yeah, yes. I'm trying to remember when we wrote it, because in some ways we have happy accidents, because I think we were sort of improvising. We knew it was like into the unknown, and sometimes it's just like what feels good for the next thing, and I think we knew it was like into the unknown, like just that that felt fun to do that melisma, and at least that's how I remember it. But
here's a question about Adina. I worked with her on a song called Small World a while ago, and she has her style of singing that's different than what's written on the page naturally. You know, she will just put herself, she naturally just goes there and is like, it's just her.
Yeah.
When she sings a song, how strict are you to the notes on the page versus sometimes being like, well, that's actually a really good choice that she's made?
We're pretty strict. Bobby is definitely a sing the ink kind of guy.
Doesn't make me sound cool, but
No, I'm the same way. So I'm asking more because it's a different, you know, sometimes you're around singers who put a great ad lib at some point, whether they meant to or not. And sometimes I question when you take the ad lib and make it part of the song. You know,
we always keep one riff that Adina adds.
Yeah.
In Let It Go, it was which one was it?
I think it's in the second chorus. Here I stand and here I'll stay.
No, I think it was,
gonna keep it in.
Light of day.
Yeah, that's it.
She added that.
It's that weird thing where, you know, it's, as a writer, part of your job is to recognize when greatness sort of just has a moment in a song. Mm-hmm. And it's that, sit back and say, yeah, okay. This is Elsa's song too. You know,
that's why you want Adina. She's connected to greatness. She's always searching for it. She's only able to really sing what feels authentic to her. She's sort of incapable of bullshit as an actress. And she that sort of primal thing that she does is from a true place within her. And that's, you're lucky to ever get to work with a singer like that. So we don't, you know, we respect the hell out of Dina's choices. And we always give her the chance to do anything she wants, but we also try and get it the way we imagined it originally. And then we, you know, then we play the game of putting it together. Like, where do we stray from what we had thought originally? That's one of the great things about getting to comp a solo performance together.
Well, that concludes our interview with Kristen and Bobby Lopez. The nature of the beast, as you know, in this COVID times, is that sometimes Zoom meetings mysteriously end. But we did finish the conversation, and just to give you an idea of what we talked about, we talked about the EGOTs and what that meant. We talked about Katie and Annie, their daughters, and they each got a chance to talk about each other. And again, afterwards, I just had an opportunity to tell them that, you know, it's so unusual for us to interview people who have excelled in so many facets, but, you know, you don't win Emmys, Grammys, Oscars, Tonys, or in, you know, in Kristen's case, a go-go, two Grammys and two Oscars. You don't win these things because you're so focused on something small. They're managing to tell stories that will be told, you know, for as long as there's theater, as long as there are people watching movies. So, again, it was so amazing to have them on, and I hope we have them on again. I hope you guys all have a wonderful Christmas, wonderful, I'm sure Hanukkah's done by the time you guys hear this, but have a wonderful New Year's, have a wonderful holiday, whatever you celebrate, and we'll be back in the beginning of 2021 with some more interviews. Super excited about it. And again, thank you for an amazing end of 2020 regarding our podcast. We hope all of you are safe. Stay at home, wear a mask, and we'll see you on the flip side. Thank you so much.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.